Welcome to Made in the 80s, podcast about the 80s by people who were made in the 80s. I'm your host, Shalia, and we have...
Tim.
And Kendon.
Made in the 80s, people who were made in the 80s. And we are here for the first week of November. How are you guys doing?
Tired?
Same. I'm tired, but I'm happy to be here.
Oh, good. Well, I'm happy you're here, too. This week, we are doing a classic. I think, Kendon, you called it a classic.
Yeah.
American classic. Field of Dreams. We thought it was appropriate because congratulations to the Red Sox for winning the World Series this week. The Dodgers and the Red Sox were the competitors this year, and it was a fun watch for the games that I paid attention to.
Were the Red Sox the ones with the curse?
Yeah, that curse was lifted. Do you remember it being lifted?
Yeah. So now it's just no big deal.
I mean, it's a big deal, but it's been, what, 10, 15? When did the curse get lifted? 2004? Yeah, almost 15 years.
Was there another curse that was lifted more recently?
The Cubs.
The Cubs! There we go. And that was like, what, 3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, well, speaking of the curse for the Red Sox, the fever pitch was done that year. Did they record while it was happening?
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that it was also the year that the curse was going to be lifted?
Mm-hmm.
That is so fortunate.
No, that's called a focused marketing plan.
Yeah.
What? I mean, but nobody can predict who's going to win the World Series.
Apparently they did.
Well, especially on a team that had been so cursed.
Maybe it was the movie. The movie was the reason.
That's what I'm thinking. Drew Barrymore has magic. Okay, I think this is also appropriate, right? Because we just got out of Halloween and now the curses are over. Haha. Right?
Also, very funny. Yes, it is.
Yes. Also, Field of Dreams is appropriate because it is a cornfield and we are in November and Kendon got corn in his sunbasket and I'm probably going to get some kind of corn in my food. Oh, no, that's a summer crop, isn't it?
No.
It's a fall crop?
It's a Thanksgiving thing.
Yeah, I think of it as a Thanksgiving
thing. In fact, I think I just found out that corn has a season because I wanted to make something like in May or June or something and I went to the produce stand and they were all out of corn. I was like, I thought corn was a year-round thing.
No. I think probably anything that they can indicates that it's not necessarily year-round. I don't know if that's true.
I don't think that's true.
Okay. Well, I'm sure our friends... I am going to go with a new thing. We keep saying listeners, but I think of you as my friends. So our friends are probably not that interested in this topic, so we're going to move on.
Tim's face right now.
So, you guys, do we have any news?
Yeah. So, this is just hot off the wires, I think. They are planning on making a remake to The Color Purple. Movie that we did, what, a few months back or several months back. And so right now there's a Broadway version of it. Is that Jennifer Hudson? Is she in it?
I didn't know there was a Broadway version.
Well, that's what they're adapting. And it's going to be, I mean, it's a collaboration between Oprah Winfrey, Steven Spielberg, and Quincy Jones, which is the same from last time.
I'm almost at a loss for words. I'm shocked by this news. wow. Yes, we did an episode about The Color Purple a few months back.
We're changing the culture. We're bringing these things back.
Yes. It's all thanks to us and our friends. Tim, what do you think about this?
I mean, it's par for the course. I mean, they've been remaking 80s movies for a while. It's not surprised that I'm surprised it took this long for someone to try to redo it again. Because it's such a popular film. So I'll be interested to see who they cast in it and if they try to update it in any way.
Oh, I hope not. Wait. By update, I mean, it's still going to be taking place in, what, the 20s and stuff?
I don't know.
Please do not change the
era. I don't know. They could.
That worries me.
I trust these three, so I'm not too worried. I think it's interesting.
See, I would trust them back when they were all at the peak of their game. And I actually don't know a lot about where Quincy is right now, but, like, Oprah's out here, like, maybe trying to run for president, and, after Steven Spielberg made, what was it, Crystal Skull. Like, I don't know that I can just trust them.
He just did Ready Player One.
Yeah, I mean, it was all right.
You don't trust that? More.
No, wait. Like, you're talking about Ready Player One and The Color Purple. Like, I can't say that the sensibilities of doing kind of a big blockbuster thing for, like, the kid in you versus addressing such serious subject matter.
I'm not concerned about those three, but what I appreciate about Quincy Jones, Oprah, and Spielberg is their ability to get top-flight talent. Not only actors, but people who do sound, people who do editing, people who do the mixing. So when you have people of that caliber, they'll be able to get all the best people to work on the project. Then that's the difference between having a good movie and a great movie. So I appreciate
it. But you have to have the writing. You have to have the writing and the heart.
They'll be able to get those people.
I mean, like I said, I'm not just going to assume that you're going to do it well.
They can't. They may not. They may or may not. But when you have someone like Oprah and someone like Quincy Jones and someone like Spielberg, they can attract the level of 10 to write a good story. It's whether or not they do it or not, but they have the ability. It's not like some no-name director who's trying to scramble together their homeboy who wrote a screenplay once in college to do this film.
Yeah, it's not likely, but I'm basically saying, I mean, George Lucas had that ability as well.
So I definitely wouldn't put these three in the same category as George Lucas right now, but I wasn't going to mention this one yet, but it's what I've been watching. I believe it's on Netflix. There's a documentary about Quincy Jones that him and his daughter made, and I just watched it this week. And like, he is still out there working and amazing and thinks things through. He was in charge of the opening program for the Smithsonian National Museum of African American Culture and History. And they showed him putting that together and just calling up people and getting Colin Powell to show up, Oprah to show up. He's like, well, we should include the president. He is very thoughtful. From that documentary, I saw him putting something together fairly recently, and he's extremely thoughtful about things. So I'm not worried.
I immediately put him to the side when I was saying, I don't know about X, Y. It was Oprah and Steven Spielberg that I'm not sure about.
Those two are deferential to him. Like, when I saw this movie or this documentary, the level of respect that people have for Quincy Jones, it was amazing. Like, he calls up Oprah and she's like, I'll show up. I'll be there.
Perfect.
So I think my concern is in this documentary, I don't pay attention that much to news, but he's had some health issues over the years, specifically related to his diabetes. And so my thing is, I just want this man to stay healthy. And he's working really hard at it. And they show that in documentary Truths. It's really good. But
by his daughter, did you mean Rashida?
Yeah. And she's amazing. Love her so much. So if I hadn't seen that documentary recently, I might have been more worried. But having seen this so recently, and it's a documentary, but like, he's in it.
Quincy
so
Jones, like, your classmate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Graduated at the same time as Tim from Garfield.
I think the big issue the movie's going to come up against is the fact that the first one was so good. And so it's going to be held up against sort of an impossible standard to match the first movie and match Whoopi Goldberg's performance. And so that's going to be the big hurdle. And that's going to, that's going to be tough. But if you can get past that, it'll be fine.
And here's my, at least for the for Whoopi's part, go for an unknown. I feel like you should definitely go for somebody who we don't have a bunch of preconceived image of.
Can I offer a suggestion? So one of the things that I prepared to do in terms of this intro part is, last week we promised that I would do a fan cast for the remake of Clueless. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who I've been considering, so I would throw this name out there for Whoopi Goldberg's character in A Color Purple, is Sierra Capri. She plays Monse in the show on My Block. I think she could do it. She's got a beautiful smile, and I love her. And then what do you think? Isn't that a good option?
Yeah, I like that character too. I like that actress.
Yeah, I think she could do it.
It's a fun show, which Leah, I'm sure, is going to talk about.
All right, well, sticking with Color Purple really quick, don't we have other news of, like, kind of specific to that and someone running their mouth a bit?
Well, that wasn't really news so much, because I think you said it happened a long time ago, where Elizabeth Banks was like trying to call out Steven Spielberg for having never directed a movie with a woman in the lead. And people were like, The Color Purple.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that's not new news, but it's an example of, especially white women, forgetting black women as if they don't matter or exist.
Right.
And so we have some more recent news of this happening. Which of you wants to mention that?
It wasn't really my news item, but yeah, Rebel Wilson had said recently, she's in a movie called some rom-com she's doing. It comes out early 2019. The trailer dropped earlier this week, and so she's been doing press, and she was on Ellen and said she was excited to be the first plus-size woman to lead a rom-com, and anyone who's watched romantic comedies in the last 10 years knows that's not true. We've had Queen Latifah and Monique and many others as leads in successful romantic comedies at that, not even just...
Was it Last Holiday? Comedy. What's the
movie? Last Holiday, Just Right, Fat Girls is the one Monique was in. Yeah, it's... But I think it speaks to a lot of people when they see these projects with black leads, they see them as just black movies and not as movies. I think it speaks to some of that.
Yeah. And I mean, I just heard about this, so... But Last Holiday came to my head very quickly. It wasn't like... Oh, that's interesting. Have there been any? No. I mean, that was... It's on
every Christmas.
What is... Yeah, it's...
It's on every Christmas.
And it's not even a black movie. There's... I mean, she's black, but there's lots of that other people... It's a black movie. Right, exactly. Like, you can have... It's like, not a full black cast. It's a lot of...
popular consciousness? Yeah. That seems to be what makes a black movie.
If it's a black lead, then all of a sudden it's... And it... I mean, yes, maybe it is... It's irritating. That is really irritating.
We see the nuance in it because we see nuance all the time as marginalized people. But others who don't have to think in that prism don't see it. It's just a black movie.
Yeah, this is a good example of like privilege, right? That I forget sometimes because I consider myself with lots of privilege. There's a lot of blessings that I have, and I appreciate that, right? This is like an example of realizing like, oh yeah, that's right. I don't see the world the same as some people, apparently. Like, it's insane. I don't understand how, I don't know, people who are invisible. It's ridiculous. Anyway, anything else you guys want to say about that?
No, it doesn't upset me at all. It's just more of the same. I'm not even upset by what she said. It's just more of like, oh, okay, you too. Doesn't even move me emotionally. I didn't have an emotional response. I just sort of read it and was like, oh, okay.
I thought it was funny when you said she was starring in a rom-com and you said, you know, some rom-com coming out in 2019. I was like, is that the title?
Yeah.
That's a good title for a rom-com. Some rom-com coming out in 2019.
All right, you guys have other news?
They're doing another Rambo movie, which I didn't know. We haven't covered any of the Rambo films. I just want to ask you both if you think Sylvester Stallone is too old to be doing these Rambo movies.
Unless he's playing the new Rambo.
Have you seen any Rambo movies ever?
No.
You?
Some, but I don't remember them very well. First Blood was my older sister Sienna's very first movie in the theaters to see, and so that was like her thing. But I don't remember them very well. My answer to this is sure if he does it the same way that Kenan was implying or alluding to is if they do it like they did with Creed. I'm fine with that. But yeah,
is he gonna be like mentoring in Afghanistan or in Iraq?
Zero idea. He's just leading a new Rambo movie. No idea what it's about, who's in it. He's just in it.
Well, we'll be getting to Rambo movies soon.
Yeah.
Was the first one 1980?
I think so.
That's First Blood.
Yeah.
He drew First Blood. And then, so Sienna was your age? She was born in 79, so she was a year old. That's her first in theater movie.
Knowing her, that's kind of a funny thing. Was she not, like, crying in the theater?
I don't know. So I wasn't alive yet. That's the reference, Liz, that Sienna loved First Blood.
Well, First Blood was 1982. Yeah,
it was 82. Oh, there you go. So she was definitely not 1 year
old. There are three Rambo movies that are... eligible, at least three that are eligible for our show.
This is hilarious. Wait, so Sienna was born in 79, that came out in 82, so she was three. So that's way more appropriate for her first movie.
No, not in any way, shape, or form. The joke for me here is that Sienna, who has a daughter, is terrified of the daughter making any sort of public disturbance during events. So it would be funny for Sienna to be in a movie like this. Making noise.
Yeah, I mean, some of our friends may have known Sienna or me as a kid, or maybe even Tiala, and they can speak to this better, but my impression or my understanding of us as kids and me being the outlier as like the worst, but the other two definitely much better than me, was that because our parents were kind of public figures, we were really good when it came to public. Like, we knew to be quiet when we were in public. So I would be surprised if Sienna had any noise in a theater, which is why she, I think, has that, I wouldn't say terrified, but yeah, has that thing about not wanting her kid to be the loud one, because we were very, we were pretty well trained to be quiet in public. Don't speak unless spoken to. Okay. Any other news from you guys?
No.
I have two pieces of news. One is, this is being released the last Monday, the day before Election Day. Tim, have you voted?
Yeah.
Good job. That was a good, quick answer.
No, the look on Tim's face, which you guys can't see, is like, why would you ask me this question? Yeah. I voted last year.
Yeah, I voted.
Not have you ever voted.
No. Like I turned in this ballot a year ago.
Well, as of last week, Friday, Kendon and I have also voted. Yay, good job, Made in the 80s crew. We are voters. We've done our civic duty?
Civic.
Any friends who
and
haven't yet?
We did
yet?
It civilly.
We did. Any friends who haven't done it yet, please go and do it. If you have any questions about maybe some local elections here in Washington State, feel free to email us, mit80s.podcast@gmail.com, because we would love to help educate people on any questions they might have about some of these races. And, so I'm mentioning that, but then also this news about, so one of our representatives in Spokane recently released this, I don't think it's a manifesto, but
it
this
is a manifesto.
This publication. And the reason we're not a political podcast, the reason I'm bringing it up is because we have talked about having a topic, an episode someday on The Handmaid's Tale. That book was one that people made in the 80s, many read as youth. It has formed some of the people that I know, who are, you know, pretty legit civil rights activists and lawyers. And so we talked about that. And then there's also the show, and we have started watching it. And so that's why I bring this up, is that The Handmaid's Tale has recently come into my world. I didn't even know it existed until this show started. And then this thing got released last week, I think, or maybe the week before.
Maybe you can mention a little bit about
the
topic.
Yep.
Of this
manifesto. What was released is this, right. I mean, the topic is basically this biblical war, and discussing that abortion and same-sex marriage is wrong, but responding to it in violence, and so like killing everybody, including men who believe it's okay. So like, it's violent. And it's concerning because this is somebody who's been in our state legislature for a lot of years and is a Republican, but that's not the issue here for me. It's a, it's scary, and it makes me feel like someone who would lead us towards something like The Handmaid's Tale if given the opportunity, and also doing it with the idea of violence behind it. And then considering last week we had a lot of violence happening and still happening in terms of people being killed specifically related to their
political beliefs or their I guess what do you say, minority status, mm-hmm. religious status.
Yeah. So it's kind of a scary time. And so I just bring that up as news because we have said I think it was actually last November that we said it, and we were like, I don't think we can read that book that quick. But someday, actually, friends, if you want us to discuss The Handmaid's Tale as a topic sometime soon, let us know. It's in the box, but we haven't gotten to it. But if you want us to push that up on the list and you're interested in it, let us know.
The book or the show?
Oh, yeah. And let us know if it's the book or the show. My thought is it's the theme in general. So it's the book, but we can also discuss some of the show. But yeah.
There have been three shows that depressed me enough that I had to stop watching for significant amounts of time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, Handmaid's Tale is on the list. Like, I was like, oh, this is, I should go back to it. But Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead. So The Handmaid's Tale is up there for me with those three shows as ones that I cannot binge, essentially.
But with the representative, what we've seen, you know, with him and others like him that are running for office during the Obama administration, a lot of these sort of extremist and the Alex Jones types, the conspiracy theory type people rose to prominence. And then once Trump took office, they sort of normalized it. As part of Trump's campaign, he would routinely go on Alex Jones show. And this guy talks about lizard people and people smelling like sulfur, and there's all these crazy videos about him. So a lot of people normalize these types, and they allow them to be on these platforms spewing this sort of craziness. And this is what happens.
So I think I'm also going to touch some on this in my What Have You Been Watching, actually.
Why don't we move into that unless you guys had any other news? Yeah. All right, Kenan, go for it.
So I've been watching along with you the 90s, which is a documentary series by, I don't remember who's making these. Is it CNN?
I think it's CBS. This is the one that I was watching last week.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, it they've done, I don't remember if they did the 50s. I keep trying to remember. They definitely did the 60s, 70s, 80s, and now they've done the 90s. The 90s, the time that we were really coming of age. Even though we're doing an 80s podcast, which is fun. We are 90s kids. Watching this makes us realize that as much as like we think of, oh, the 90s were like this great time, like I think it's just because we were kids. Because there's a lot of wild shit going on in the 90s.
What is the show about?
Oh, it's just it's a documentary of the like a lot of the major events and trends and culture of the 90s. The first two episodes were about music.
So those are the ones that I mentioned last week. The first two episodes were about TV. The third episode is about music. And so this week you have watched some others. And the thing that is interesting about the way that they do this is they started off really fun. Friends will remember last week I was like, the 90s were wonderful. Oh my gosh, they were amazing. I can't wait till we review the 90s. And it's true. The two episodes that we had watched were really fun. It was a fun time. The ones that I got to talk about last week were great. And now Kenan gets to talk about some that are not as fun. And it actually, it's a good way to see that the 90s weren't as amazing as I thought they were last.
Yeah. So we get into, well, for instance, what we were just talking about, kind of extremism. One of the episodes is basically all on terrorism or like extremist violence, which right now in our culture we really associate with basically Islamic terrorism.
That's a like a capital we, not necessarily everyone.
Yeah, sure. It's what is pushed forward as the main thing to be concerned about. But there was a lot of anti-government sort of sentiment and anti-government like militia movement, and I think like previous to the World Trade Center going down, I think the Oklahoma City bombing was the biggest domestic terrorism to happen on our soil, and that was somebody who was Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, was that the other guy's name? But Timothy McVeigh, I think it was on the 2-year anniversary of the federal government's violent response to some people at Ruby Ridge. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he decided he wanted to get back at the government by killing a bunch of kids. I mean, that's a little bit reductive, but like, how do you choose like a target that's basically a bunch of people going to work? Like, this is, like, these people just, I don't understand a lot of the mentality that goes behind this sort of thing. There was also the Branch Davidians, in which they were, you know, holed up in their compound, apparently buying parts that would allow you to convert weapons into, from semi-automatic to fully automatic. The ATF didn't like that. There was a standoff. and it ended in a lot of violence and a lot of death.
This is what we know as Waco, Texas? Mm-hmm. Or is that something different?
Mm-hmm, that's it.
That's Waco, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's that. I mean, there was also the early developments of Al-Qaeda. So there was, I think they were responsible for the USS Cole bombing, the embassy in Tanzania, and there's another one that I'm missing.
And didn't the original World Trade Center bombing end up being connected with somebody who ends up being a leader of Al-Qaeda?
Right. I think it was the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So, and that is immortalized in that Notorious B.I.G. lyric, Blown Up Like the World Trade, which I didn't get when the song was out, or like when I was listening to the song, because I didn't know about it. And when I would listen to it after 9/11, I was like, wait, that doesn't make sense. Oh, right. That's because it was on, what's it called? The Juicy. Blueprint.
So Juicy.
Right, no, but on The Blueprint 2, Jay-Z has that whole verse in the opening. Mm-hmm. And they actually blank out World Trade, mm-hmm, for that version. And so I looked up, like, what are the lyrics? I looked it up, and I was like, how did he know about that?
How did he predict?
Yeah. So there's that. And one of the more fun ones, actually, is the episode on the Information Age. The expansion of essentially going from the 80s, which were all about hardware for computers, you know, personal computers. And now we're going into software, how, you know, Bill Gates realized that software, the operating system, could be a lot more valuable than the hardware, and you see how much money and, you know, how successful he is with that business model. But then the next generation being the internet, which they were behind on, they didn't catch that, and so he was trying to play defense. Netscape at the time was the big player there, and he attempted, this is Bill Gates, he attempted to address that by creating Internet Explorer, bundling it in with Windows, and basically requiring hardware manufacturers who are using Windows to, you know, promote Internet Explorer at the detriment of Netscape. And the internet, or the government got involved and sued for it on antitrust grounds. And it was a very interesting point, which Shalia, I think, had some insight in. But, like, the one of the people said, you know, A, if the U.S. government is very good at litigation, if they decide to come after you, they will come after you, like, they hit the NOS pedal. That's the only other thing I'm thinking of Fast and the Furious now.
I appreciate that. They didn't say federal government. They said government. They were like, if there's one thing the government is good at, it's litigation, which I love because that makes me feel good at something.
And then the other thing that I thought you would, that you had the input on, was how somebody who, so that he had to be, he was deposed during this process. And they're like, no matter how powerful you are in your own sphere, you know, you hear a lot of, like, Bill Gates in the documentary, like, you hear tape of him speaking to people who work for him, or in interviews, and he gets to be, like, very flippant, or he gets to be very aggressive. And they're like, when you're deposed, there's only one thing you can do, which is sit and answer the questions truthfully. Like, that's all you can do. Because if you start lying under oath, like, they'll send you to jail, or they'll, whatever. That is what happens when you lie under oath during a deposition. Or do you find?
It depends, right? Like, I'm pretty sure that if you say something in deposition that's not true, basically you're going to get impeached later, so it goes to your credibility. If your deposition is under oath, then yeah, it could be perjury. And so then you've got the penalties of perjury that you're facing.
Yeah. So it's interesting, the version of Bill Gates that you hear on the deposition tapes versus, like, his public persona or him in a business room setting.
Yeah. So that's what Kenan's been watching. Friends, you should watch this. I mean, so in terms of this Information Era episode, there's a lot that we already know about this because it's fairly recent history in terms of like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. And I am very familiar with a lot of this. And then also, right, like in terms of like the antitrust laws and anti-competitive issues, like I'm aware of that stuff too. But they did. I'm really impressed with CBS because they've done this in a way to make it still relevant and to still show you stuff that you haven't seen before. So yeah, seeing the actual footage from Bill Gates's deposition, seeing footage from Bill Gates's interviews, and now I'd only really known him as this, the current Bill Gates, like a leader, philanthropist, someone who I look up to and think cares about humanity a lot. And yet in these clips, I'm like, oh, he was just kind of a guy.
He was like, I mean, it makes you think of, what is Facebook dude's name?
Mark Zuckerberg.
Mark Zuckerberg. Like right now, I feel like, Bill Gates has kind of more of a kindly uncle, social image, you know, like he's doing a lot of good through his foundation and stuff like this, which is not the image you have of Mark Zuckerberg right now, but maybe our kids will if he like calms down and starts doing a lot of philanthropy.
Yeah. So it is, even if you feel like you know a lot about this stuff already, there is still, I suspect for most of us, some new content in these episodes that you may not know. So highly recommended.
A slight correction, it is CNN who, this is a CNN miniseries.
That's hilarious.
Okay. And produced and largely narrated by Tom Hanks.
Yes, Tom Hanks is part of this.
And they haven't done the 50s.
Okay. Anything else that you've been watching, Hendon, thinking about doing?
No, not right now.
Okay. Tim, what are you up to?
I said we're half hour in, so I'll keep it super brief. I watched Flesh and Blood on Hulu. They're doing like a scary movie a month kind of thing. It's about a girl who thinks her dad is a serial killer. And he has this sort of thing, sort of handicap, where she can't leave the house. She has all these weird things. She can't leave her home. So she's sort of stuck in this house with a guy who she now thinks is a serial killer. And she's trying to figure out whether or not her dad is a murderer and if he murdered her mom.
Do you mean like physically, or she's like agoraphobic?
Agoraphobic.
Okay.
Yeah. So she can't. So every time she tries to leave, she's, you know, can't really anxiety function. Yeah, she can't really function. So yeah, it's worth a watch if you like. It's not scary. It's more of a thriller. The dad was a little too over the top for my liking, but it was a fun watch.
Truly, I can't watch it. She has too much imagination.
Spoiler alert. Is he a serial killer, Tim?
I'm not going to spoil it.
So, Kenan, do you remember when I thought you might be a serial killer?
See, I didn't want you to put this on mic. And like I said, Shalia's got too much imagination. She was just, I don't know why she wanted, she was like.
I can share this. Insight is, he had been watching a lot of Dexter, and he's a meat eater. And so he was like heating up some ham in the kitchen, and I was like, God, how does he just eat flesh like that? And then I started thinking about how, you know, I work all day. I don't know what he does most of the time. I don't actually know where he is when I'm at work. Maybe he's killing people. Maybe he could be, it's possible he could be a serial killer. And then I was in my room and was like, are there bodies under my bed? And started having those kind of thoughts. But Kenan, what did you say to make me feel better about you not being a serial killer?
I don't remember.
Well, first you called out my lack of really realistic understanding of biology, and that like if there were dead bodies under our bed, they would be rotting and we would be smelling them. And then you also pointed out your actual personality and character, and how like yeah, that's not really like you're something that you would really put a lot of effort into, something like that. I don't remember. And maybe Kenan is a serial killer. He's having a hard time convincing us otherwise today.
I'm definitely not. So I always want to say the first reason is that it's completely immoral. But the other reason is there's a ton of shit that I like to do that I will not be able to do if I get arrested and sent to jail.
That's it. Like his response was a very rational one, which was like, oh yeah, that's right.
So they don't let you have Legos or video games or like a high tech PC.
Yeah.
in prison.
But I do feel for this girl in this wait, did you say it's a show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's a movie.
Okay, yeah, I feel for the girl in this movie, especially if she can't get out. Like, that's scary. For that, like, 2 minutes I thought Kenan might...
what? In a horror movie?
Yeah, I know, exactly. She can't get out.
Get out.
Yeah, for that, like, 2 minutes I thought I might be living with one. It was really, really scary. Anything else you've been up to?
Yeah.
Okay. I will also try to keep this quick. So, what I've been watching this week are a bunch of teen dramas, because last week we left off, we were going to have me fan cast Clueless, and I started thinking about it and then being like, wait, I don't even know, like, who's playing teenagers these days, because, like, I'm old. So, I watched some teen dramas that were on my list anyway, and so the first one I watched was the first season of On My Block, which is based in California and is amazing. These kids are so funny. Thumbs up from Kendon. It was funny because I was like, okay, I have a gist of these actors. I can move on. But then I was like, I don't want to because I want to finish this season.
It's a Netflix original.
And so then I also watched Riverdale, and I'm blanking on another one. But anyway, so I've been watching a lot of teen dramas, which is just kind of funny.
I think we're going to get back to Riverdale because I had mentioned several months back that I had started on it, and it was kind of weird interesting.
Yeah, I wasn't that interested in it, but I stopped so that Ken could join me in watching it together. But so what I'm going to do is tell you guys my fan cast for Clueless. All right, let me get to it. Hold on. All right, so here's my picks. And you may not be familiar with all of them because you guys are as old as I am, but... I am recommending... Okay, no, that's not it. Drum roll, please. Okay, so for Cher, I'm recommending Ronnie Hawk. She plays Olivia in On My Block. She's Native American, which is exciting to me in terms of diversity and cast. I didn't know that until I was trying to figure out how old she was and whether this was age appropriate. But I think she's great. I think she's beautiful. I think she can play Cher really well. At some point in the film, if they do like a painting of her mom like they did in the original, I hope that her mom is Alicia Silverstone, who played the original Cher, because I think that'll be great.
I'm looking, and I agree.
All right. So for Dion, I have decided to cast Zashir Zamata from SNL, because I think she's hilarious and I think she could do a wonderful job in this role, because it's a funny sidekick role. And so that's my cast for Dion. For Ty, I have...
Was Stacey Dash like super old compared to the other actors? Is that... Zashir Zamata is our age. She's over 30. Over 30.
Yeah, so I'm using Movie Magic here. I like these my picks are people who I think that can play these characters in this movie, and I think that they can all mix, but it might be wrong. Like, it might not work when you actually put them up next to, when you actually put them up next to each other, it may not work, but I think that it could. For example, On My Block, they have a 30-something-year-old actor in high school, and they're like, oh, kids are supposed to be freshmen. So they're like 19-year-olds playing freshmen in high school, and they have a 30-year-old who's also a freshman with them. So a lot of this is me putting a cast together that I think will fit, and I've done it very carefully.
I'm sorry to have interrupted.
It's okay. So I think that she can do it. Was it Lupita Nyong'o? Who played Dion for Halloween this year? It was hilarious. Oh my God. So if you guys haven't looked up this costume, I almost changed it to make her it, because she was having so much fun in this costume. She even had the fake one with the cheap Kmart hair that she found in Murray's car. It was hilarious. So if she wants to play it, that's cool. If Sashira isn't available. Okay, so for Ty, that's the one that Brittany Murphy played. I was wanting to put Sierra Capri on there, that's Monse, because I think she can look kind of plain, but then she can also, when they do like the makeover, she is gorgeous, and she has personality, which I think is really important for that character. So I was thinking that she would be great. She's the one who plays Monse in On My Block. Or Zendaya. I think that she also has a great character. You can like put her in some overalls and dress her down. And then obviously she's stunning. So either of those two I think would be great in that character, because they both have a lot of character and personality, which is what you need for that role. For Christian, I'm throwing in Diego Tinoco, who's also from On My Block. He plays Caesar because I just think he's a cutie. And I can see him hanging out with them in the pre. I can see them being like, oh, he's so hot. This is the guy I want to be with. And then him being gay and being like, okay, you're my best friend. I can see both him playing both roles. So I think that would work.
So do you kind of want to just like copy and paste all of On My Block?
I would love to, but no, I didn't do that. I tried. So like Ruby, for example, who's played by Jason Genau, I tried to put him in there, but I was just like, I think he's too young. Like, I don't think I can put him in with this cast. But I don't know. I actually don't know how old he is. Okay. So for Elton, I have casted Colin from SNL. Because I think he could play that role really well, and I think it would be great. For Amber, she's like the redheaded one who's just kind of a diva, irritating, not like frenemy. And I put Madeline Pesch. I don't know if that's how you say her last name. She plays Cheryl Blossom in Riverdale. She's like the evil, one of the evil twins. I wouldn't want her playing as dark and evil a character as she plays in Riverdale, but I think, I mean, obviously she can turn it on. So she is Amber. So Josh is the older brother stepbrother who then becomes a love interest. And I would make him Brandon Bell, who plays Troy in Dear White People. And then, so to play Cher's dad, I have decided on Benjamin Bratt. And I think he'll be great in that. For the Travis is like the stoner pothead skater kid who Ty will end up wanting to be with. And so I'm putting Pete Davidson from SNL because he can definitely play that character really well. And I think it'll be funny. And then the other kids are Murray and Lawrence. So Murray is Dion's boyfriend and Lawrence is Murray's best friend. So for Murray, I have decided on Michael Shea from SNL.
So basically, hold on.
So basically, so what I'm
envisioning
like,
is Shalia was watching a bunch of teen dramas throughout a Saturday, a lazy Saturday. She got to about 11 or midnight, said, I'm going to watch SNL for a while, and then I'm going to finish this homework. And then she just plugged in a bunch of SNL people.
That's not how it actually, to be honest, I can see how that would be what it looks like. But in fairness, actually, the SNL people were the ones I had first. Like, I was like, these guys are so funny, and I think it would be really great. And then I started plugging in others as I was learning about actual, like, teenage actors. And then Lawrence is his best friend, and I think Winston Duke would play him really well and be funny. So Michael Shea and Winston Duke together. I don't know what you're showing me right now.
Madeline Pesch is from Port Orchard.
There we go. Washington. I even casted a local here for Amber. And then the others are the teachers. So the two teachers that they try to hook up, I went with Tessa Thompson and Matthew Morrison from Glee. So that is Shalia's version of Clueless Remake Fan Cast. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, you guys ready to get into it? Or do you have any comments on my, I mean, Kenan commented the whole time. Tim's got no comment. Would you watch that movie?
No.
Aww.
I'm not a big Clueless fan.
Tessa Thompson's in it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't watch it even if Tessa Thompson's in it?
No, he'd watch it.
I'm not a big Clueless fan.
He's not telling us that.
I'm just not.
He needs plausible deniability.
I watch whatever. I don't have any shame in watching it. I'm just not a fan of Clueless.
What if
the idea of a Clueless reboot doesn't move me at all?
What if Shalia was credited as casting director?
Then that would be me supporting my friend.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So, dream job when I was a kid, like Barbie years, like playing with Barbies, I wanted to be a casting director. And I used to be like, who's going to play this role? Let me call Luke Perry. Let me call Jenny Garth from 90210, from 90210. And I don't know if you've noticed, but my initials are CSA, and almost all movies are credited in the beginning by like casting by CSA. So I always thought it was kind of my destiny that like things would be casted by CSA, which is me. So thank you for saying that you'll support my cast, because I think that this one is good and legit. And these kids are amazing, even the ones who are my age. It's going to be a good movie, but thank you for letting me go with that. Okay. You guys, if you podcast it, they will listen.
Two thumbs up.
We're talking Field of Dreams.
Only if you think my joke is funny.
Which joke is yours?
Field of Dreams is as American as Field of Dreams.
I do think that's funny.
This movie is so American.
It is.
It's got
I think that sounds right.
Baseball, corn, farming, the Midwest, fatherhood, right? Mm-hmm. And something else I forgot.
Well, you've got like the anti-war hippies, political commentary, financial issues.
No. I'm thinking about the sort of thing that you promote as American. The financial issues are not what we're in, or anti-war. I'm just thinking about like the down-home, like, or you know what I mean? Tim's just looking at me like,
no.
He's like, I'm from Seattle.
No.
South End. this movie, I can see why it was extremely popular.
So we're doing 1989's Field of Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
It's most popular for the If You Build It, They Will Come line, which has been reproduced and repackaged in comedies, in dramas, and all kind of stuff.
Just to clarify, If You Build It, He Will Come. And that matters because you think the he is Shoeless Joe Jackson, but turns out it's not.
Spoilers.
Yeah.
It's directed by Phil Alden Robinson, stars Kevin Costner, James Earl Jones, Ray Liotta, Amy Madigan, and Gabby Hoffman. And Burt Lancaster is in this as well.
Who's Burt Lancaster?
He's an actor.
Like, would I recognize him?
Yeah. Hold on, pull up his IMDb. Hold on.
All right, I got it.
All those old movies. Wyatt Earp. Yeah, he's in a bunch of old movies.
Famous cast, well done, I would say. Ray Liotta, this is the Ray Liotta that I picture. And so every time I see things like, was it Turbulence that he was in? Mm-hmm. And then Goodfellas? Is that the other one that he's mm-hmm. seeing that one?
Ray Liotta?
Yeah, those are the two like characters he plays where I'm like, that's not the Ray Liotta I know.
He also voiced the character in Grand Theft Auto. What is the one where they're down in Miami?
Vice City,
which was a great casting choice, I feel like.
He's
the voice of the main character that you control.
I really wish Ray Liotta's character from Goodfellas showed up in this movie and it was him in the field. That would have been a much better movie.
Aw, that's not like as good.
I don't love it. It's fine. It's just creepy. The whole movie's creepy.
I'm looking at Burt Lancaster, and I think his sub-story might be my favorite part of the movie.
All right, let's get into it. So we've got Kevin Costner is our lead, and he has moved to Iowa to where his wife is from and decided to start a farm, like her family business. And so they have a farm of corn, and he's bored. His dad is dead, and he is getting into the age where his father was. So he's 36, which I think is funny because some of us in the room are 36. Some of us are almost 36. No, we're not. Me and Kendon are not 36 yet. But we're close to it. Anyway, this is kind of like a midlife crisis almost. Like, I'm getting to the years of my dad. His dad died before they reconciled. He's got regrets. He's thinking about it. And now he's starting to hear voices in his head when he's in the field.
And I think an interesting aspect of this is that his father was a single father, right? I think his mother had died when he was pretty young.
Yeah, I think that's right. So he decides to build, he follows the voice because he's having like visions of Shoeless Joe Jackson. His father was really into baseball, tried to play, wasn't successful. And so he's really into baseball in like a kind of tortured way. So he plows half his crop or more. I don't remember how much, like what proportion, but he plows down a lot of his field and puts in a baseball field. And sure enough, Shoeless Joe Jackson shows up. So Tim, you said this is creepy. Yes. Creepy AF. This movie is scary.
Oh, is it scary? It's just creepy. It's just odd that he's having these weird dreams and he's feels like this is the direction he needs to go, and he's seeing these, they're ghosts. They're not, And what we know of Ghost, it's odd that he immediately just is all warm and fuzzy with the Ghost, and it doesn't have any trepidation about seeing an actual ghost of a person in the field, and he's playing catch and playing baseball with them. So doesn't scare him at all.
I'm curious how the two of you, well, we just got out of spooky October, so maybe that's how you guys are thinking about spirits. But I'm wondering how you two watched this, because I watched it at home a few weeks ago, like on a sick day in the middle of the day, so the sun was up. And I was eating soup to make myself feel better. And this was a very, like, at home in the middle of the day with some soup sort of movie. So I didn't get creepy out of it. I didn't get any of it.
Okay. Let's strip away, did you know it's Field of Dreams? This dude builds something because he heard a voice in his head. When he builds it, a spirit shows up.
Awesome.
And he's speaking to him. And they're playing catch.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's not my idea of awesome.
Which is very good because Tim loves scary movies, but apparently not. Ones where the ghosts aren't actually trying to kill you.
Yeah. Obviously.
This is something I've been trying to get across to Shalia, I guess, for a long time. Like, the existence of ghosts does not mean that they're out to harm you or any of this.
What I'm saying, like, what we know of ghosts, why when they show up.
We don't know anything about ghosts.
What we know of ghosts in our pop culture, in all of our entertainment, what we know of ghosts. It's the same with Teen Wolf, right? What we know of werewolves. The fact that these things show up and no one has, even at the end of the movie where he's arguing he wants to go with them.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, man. You want to go where?
Hey, it's the opportunity of a lifetime.
Good job. So this is 1989. Maybe things have changed a little bit in culture and things. I have been afraid of ghosts and spirits forever and dead people. So I don't think we've talked about this on the cast before, but my grandparents ran the cemetery where my mom lived. And so it was like just like almost like at the end of the block is the cemetery. And we spent a lot of time there while, you know, they were mowing the yard and all of that, like picking up pine cones. And I mean, I have spent a lot of time in the cemetery and I have been scared and nervous. And I would say that. And I am really scared. And my grandma, though, was one who'd just be like, why? What do you think that if a ghost showed up? These are all our family members that we're caring for, because it is. It's like my family is there. And now both my grandparents are there now, too. And that's what be her question to me as like a little kid is just like, what are you afraid of? Like, even if you did, like, even if that were the case and one showed up, like, they would love you. Like, they would, you're their kid. They would be happy to see you.
Yeah. I'm immediately thinking of Coco or like elements of, I think, Japanese culture where it's like the spirits come and they sit down and y'all hang out. Well, I mean, it's maybe a little more formal in Japanese culture.
So I have a question for you both. Do we think that Terrence Mann is dead this whole time? No. James Earl Jones' character.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, this was really hard. Like, so getting into like the physics and things of this, it's, Kenan, you asked about like how we watched this. I have seen this movie so many times in my life in every type of scenario. Never have I thought of Terrence Mann as potentially not alive. Until the most recent time I watched it. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is confusing to me and that makes all of this so confusing is the doctor and how the old doctor is a ghost, is dead. And then he is the young doctor, also the ghost. And when he leaves the field, he turns back into the ghost old doctor and then walks away. And I'm like, where are you going?
So but doesn't he save the kid?
Yeah, he saves the kid as a ghost. Because he's a ghost when he's introduced to him in his clinic. And so it's, or his office. So the whole structure of the film is like really beyond my mind to really understand Field of Dreams.
But okay, so, well, Terrence Mann, am I right that he's sick in this movie?
No, he's just isolated. He's like come out of society and closed off. He's not ill.
Tell him that he's ill or he's dying?
I think he's dead the whole time. Because when they're having that conversation at the end where Kevin Costner becomes super selfish and is like, I did this for me. How come I don't get to go? Like, he's flexing on his privilege about, I built this whole stadium and I want to go.
You kind of felt him on that, though.
I don't. It's not for you. You're supposed to, it was the selfless act, supposedly, that he all of a sudden then turned selfish.
But I didn't ever get that this was a selfless act at all.
But then when Shooter Joe Jackson says that he didn't get an invitation, like, what was that? I think the invitation was death. Yes. That's the invitation that
that man had.
And I think he's been dead the whole
time.
I think he's been dead the whole time. He doesn't die on the field.
No.
I think he's been dead the whole time. And he needed.
Dies as he walks into the corn.
No.
Like a Yoda thing.
So no.
You think his dead body is in the corn?
Yeah, because there's a physical dead body somewhere. I think he's been dead the whole time. And part of Kevin Costner's journey was bringing him to the field and off to wherever afterlife. I think that was his job.
I think that's an entirely reasonable read. It's just, I don't get that from the movie.
I think it makes sense because the idea is when you pass, where does your spirit live? Like, what time? Mm-hmm. And so for Terrence Mann, he's been stuck in his apartment, isolated with people. You know, he was a famous writer and then people turned on him. And so that's where he's been. And the call for him is ease his pain. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. Like, he's spending his afterlife. His spirit is stuck in pain. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is, let's bring him to the field and he can write about us and, like, be with the guys who are spending their spirit years playing baseball. And then I think what helps with that is going back to the doctor. You know, he has the chance to spend the rest of his spirit life as a kid playing in the time where he played with these guys and how fun it was. And he's like, nah, I want to spend my spirit years in this time where I have a wife and I'm helping. Like, the most valuable part of my life was as a doctor, and in this other phase. And so he's like, I'm staying in this world. But he could have also spent his time in his afterlife with those baseball players.
And also think what Kevin Costner builds isn't a baseball field. It's some gateway to the afterlife.
Sure. Yeah. And I get that. Yeah, I just definitely felt as if Terrence Mann was alive. But, and that's maybe why I felt, maybe it was from another movie or something, but I felt like he was holding back that he was dying. Not that he was dead, because I felt like all of those interactions they had together, they didn't have that eerie, dreamlike quality that they have when they go back to see the doctor.
But even with the kid that they pick up, he's, you know, that's a dead guy. They don't have that eerie. He just hops in the van like, A-okay, guys.
Everything you're saying, it's a completely reasonable, sure, but, well, that happens right after the doctor thing,
though. Yeah, and it introduces
that idea. Mm-hmm. I really feel like there's so much, like, what feels to me like practical, down-to-earth stuff that happens. He goes and finds him. He goes to a game in public with him. He goes and does all of this stuff.
But he has no interaction with anyone else.
I don't know. I mean,
he doesn't. So what do we see? We see him with him at the game. There's no interaction with anyone else. We see them talking. No, he only has other interaction with Costner's family and other dead people.
Yeah, you're totally, like I say, everything you're saying is completely valid and completely, it's just the read of the movie, the language of the movie, to me, I'm interpreting, is not that he's dead, but that his time has come.
And I think it works either way, to be honest. Maybe he's, like, his body's going to, I don't know. I think that's fine. Going to the idea of, like, Kevin Costner being like, I want to go, and they're like, you're not invited. I think that, like, that was interesting. And it either way, if whether James Earl Jones was alive or dead at that point, like, his explanation of why it makes sense that he goes is, I've lived my life. Like, I have done all this. You still have a lot to do in your life. You're 36, right? You've got a lot to do. And so it really had to do with age and experience.
It's a one-way journey.
It's a one-way journey. And so it made sense that he would be the one to go. I have a question about that part of the movie too, because so all of a sudden Annie's brother can see them because Sam, the kid her name's not Sam, but she plays Sam in one of my very, very, very favorite films, Now and Then. So shout out to Now and Then. It was such a good movie. And so then all of a sudden he sees him. But like the idea of like, okay, so we have these famous baseball players here playing and all of these people will come to watch. Are these ghosts that are going to come to watch? No. Are they going to be paying real money? Mm-hmm. So real people are going to come and watch ghosts play? It didn't seem... Is that realistic? Like, let's pretend that the ghost playing baseball that we can see is realistic. Mm-hmm. Is it realistic that this can be a thing that people will come and watch?
Hey, if you know that the afterlife is real, and there's one place where you can come and see it.
But they're not selling that. They're selling baseball. It wasn't like, come watch the afterlife party. They're selling like, people are going to come and watch baseball.
Played by people who are undead, right?
Right.
Yeah.
They're not selling the afterlife.
No, but you are.
So part of what James Earl Jones says for this is that people will come longing for the past, money they have, and it's peace they lack. So I've wondered, like, but this is just a very specific generation of for people who are going to get peace from watching this baseball game, I would think.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's the target audience of this movie in 1989.
What do you think happens after this movie's over with Costner and his family?
Oh, he gets committed.
No, sorry, they make money. People come to watch the ghost play. No. They make money. You see the lights. When it spans out, you see all the cars coming because people are going to come and watch.
But this is exactly where I'm going with, like, so you guys ask, where's the body if he goes into...
Right.
This movie's not concerned with those practicalities. It's not about the economics of how he's going to run a baseball field full of zombies. That's not at all the point. It's about the feeling.
Are you surprised none of these ghosts are racist?
I'm sure they are.
Yeah. They're just cool with James Earl Jones.
Sure, why not? Well, I mean, because cool with them. So have these
ghosts. They mentioned Ty Cobb, which is even funnier.
Paying attention to the developments over time, you know.
Have they had any real interaction with people of color?
I don't know. But the thing is you know, I don't know.
It's the same with Captain America. Like he's goes in the ice in 1940s and pops out and just takes.
Captain America.
But he just takes, direction from Nick Fury, like he's not looking around like, hey, you guys know this is got a black guy telling you guys what to do, huh?
I mean, he has times have changed. Superior officer deference
thing. Got you. But yeah, I don't know if they, when they all popped back up, especially Ty Cobb, who's like a known racist.
Do you know what,
when they mentioned him, I was like, it'd be funny if Ty Cobb showed up and started just dropping N-bombs in this movie.
You know what's interesting is you can do like a little bit of searching and like find how racist like Superman has been over time.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Just talking about yellows or whatever it is that he's doing. It's like, okay, sure. But again, like I say, this is, it's not about the economics. It's not about the dirty mess of bodies. It's not about the dirty mess of hate.
It's just a fantasy.
It really is. And it's interesting because like we've just watched the 90s and we were talking about like our impression of how the 90s were this like great time between the Cold War and the War on Terror and all of this stuff. But no, there was a lot of really bad things going on, but that all falls away with a certain sort of hindsight or retrospective.
Yeah. I would have loved to see one of the players refuse to play with James Earl Jones. Just like, I'm not doing it. I'm going to sit out.
But you he's really not wanna, playing,
you really
right?
Wanna, like,
he's
drag just, this movie yeah. down.
I mean, he's not playing. He's just reporting. Like, he's going to be the voice for them. The players, they don't even want him spectating? Mm-hmm. That's your thought?
No.
They don't want him.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure black people have been economically driving sports for a long time in terms of watching it. And I don't think that, even if they weren't willing to play with other players, but in that time, they did have black players. And these are the best of
no.
No.
What year was that?
1929.
What? I don't know what year was Jesse or
so was Joe Jackson?
No.
The 1919 White Sox, right?
I'm Robinson.
Jackie Robinson was 1947, I think.
1947.
Okay, yeah, so they're okay. But they're not. Yeah, he's not a player. He's gonna write about it. So I can see it being all right.
So I guess I'm almost feeling in Shalia's, what movie was it? Pretty Woman? Something that you were really diehard. Okay, so I got to admit here, a little embarrassing. I got fully misty-eyed watching this movie, particularly when James Earl Jones gives his speech and I was starting to recover. And then a little while longer... Kevin Costner walks out to the field as the catcher is taking off his and he realizes who it is. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh.
Yes.
Like there's very few, I guess I have to defend my manliness or whatever. There's
it's
very
so
few
great.
Movies that can get me like that, but, and I wasn't expecting it. But, like, this is a great movie.
So, this, I agree, Kenan. It is, I think, a great movie.
Damn.
Wait, hold on. Let's focus on the great. I agree. It is absolutely a great movie. And, like, how the tone of the movie is this interesting. Like, you're trying to figure it out the whole time. Kind of a monotone, almost, if not depressing. And then...
There's all the money problems.
Well, that and just, like... You know, Ray Liotta shows up and he's just like talking to him. I mean, a lot of it is just talking and the feeling that I get is very almost somber for a lot of the movie. And then it ends in, like, with that high. And I think it's so amazing, especially with the idea of, like, getting to see your dad again, like, or somebody that you love so much and you have some, like, conversations that you haven't been able to have yet. And did you notice that the first time that Ray Liotta smiles in the entire movie is at that point? When he smiles and looks over at the catcher. And it's like it's a signal of, like, wait. And I was like, oh, yeah, he hasn't smiled. And he's like, it's this, like, just Ray Liotta smile. And it's like, wait, what? What is this? And then it's his dad. I don't remember if I cried when I saw this ever. But I get it, Kenan. Man, it's really touching. Also creepy, though, in terms of, like, when the kid is the first one who sees Sheila Joe Jackson, where she's like, dad, 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 there's a man outside. I was like, fuck, like, creepy, too. And my other thing is, like, when it comes, going back to, like, the spirits and ghosts and stuff, it's like, yeah, I bet there are probably some good ghosts out there, but there are also bad ghosts out there then, because not all people are good. So yeah, I don't know which one it is.
Not all people are good. Like, some of them will, like, cut you off in traffic or cheat you on a business deal or something. Like, the sort of thing that I feel like you're scared of are, like, spirits of vengeance or demonic things, and I don't think there's as much of that out there.
Yeah. Okay, Tim, you have been, like, razzing on this quite a bit. Is there anything else you wanted to say about it?
I'm not razzing. It's not, I get why people enjoy it. It didn't connect with me in that way at all. I just thought it was fine. It's a lot creepier now looking at it as an adult. The physics of it don't make sense. What happens at the end of it doesn't make sense. Like, are people just going to show up and watch dead people play baseball? The racism of baseball in the 1919s is absent in this film. There's just none of it. None of these guys, they're all cool with everything. The dad thing at the end is very touching still, when his dad pops out the corn and he introduces his granddaughter and they have a moment is touching. But it's funny, because all the emotion you think would be in that moment all feels very muted, and I don't know why.
I think that goes to what I was saying about the tone of this movie is kind of muted the whole time.
The whole time?
And so that didn't feel muted to me, because it's like, it got me. Like, I'm in it. And I think the way the tone is it pulled me in, kind of like a moth to a flame or, like, to a light, where I'm just, like, very focused in on it. And so when that happened, I'm just like, whoa. The other thing, though, about being muted was the dad didn't know, like, this is a younger dad who doesn't know his kid, doesn't know anything. So it's also kind of an interesting, like, we can't be like, hey, dad, it's great to see you. So that's, I think, another reason why I was a bit muted.
Yeah. Cause how does he not know? Cause if they have all this other information, how does the dad not know?
My impression is, like, Sheila Joe Jackson's been around, but, like, a lot of them have stayed in these glory years and they are not aware of what's happened up to date. Mm-hmm. Like, they seem like that is where they are, and they're not, like, you know, passively observing the living world and what they're up to. Mm-hmm. That was my impression from the way the players were.
I just believing in the goodness.
Yeah. So, Cannon, what's your favorite thing about this movie?
Well, I wanted to throw one more thing in here. Who do you think the whispering voice is?
It's Ray Liotta.
You think so?
Yeah, because then he just says, if you build it. In the end, he's like, Ray, if you build it, he will come. Smiles and looks at the dad.
Yeah. So it's credited, the voice is credited as himself. And so there's not been a confirmation of who actually does that voice.
But yeah, Kevin Costner's like, it was you. It was you the whole time. Okay. So he doesn't say it's not.
My favorite thing is probably, it's got to be, what's the author's name?
Terrence Mann.
Terrence Mann. Or I should just say, James Earl Jones. He's great. Every single, like, part that he's in, like, their interactions in his apartment, when it's kind of an antagonistic, him going with him to the game, the sort of joy and, like, jovial, like, enjoyment at the game, the way he smiles and laughs is very comforting.
He has that great, like, belly laugh, deep voice belly laugh. Love it.
And then once he's committed to it and he's, like, they go, they see the doctor and that whole weird time traveling, like, and then his speech at the end, which is what got me, about, you know, just the goodness of and the purity of certain things, minus all of the reality and the dirt that's actually on it that Tim sees. There's got to be something positive to believe in. So, and then, he walks off into, like, I, especially because he's Vader's voice, I guess, right? He walks out into the cornfield and disappears. Yes, and chops over. Okay.
All right, yeah, you are getting, this is karma. You are getting it. Like, you are feeling this, and Tim didn't like it and is keeping it like, no. I'm sorry, babe. I know how this feels.
I don't dislike the movie. I don't connect with it in the same way. I don't dislike it. I would highly recommend this to people who want to see it. I think it's a classic. I think it's a classic in the sense that people reference it so much that I think for that alone, you should probably watch it.
Turns back, like, in terms of that scene in the field as he's going, you're talking about James Earl Jones, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's shivers. Like, I get shivers. Like, it's touching.
And so this is not intended as an argument on my behalf, but just to let listeners know, it was in 2017. In 2017, it was inducted into the Library of Congress.
Oh, that's so great.
What did they say? Usually culturally, historically significant. I don't remember the wording usually, but...
Yeah, so one of the reasons this film came up now in our podcast is that we found it on Netflix. So that might be why it's on there right now. So friends, if you are interested in watching it, you haven't seen it lately or ever, it's on Netflix. At least it was when we were watching it.
Culturally, episode. Historically, or aesthetically?
Aesthetically significant. My favorite part of this is also, the first is just the straight up, it's all about the family and how important that is, right? Bringing back our Fast and Furious and Vin Diesel. I love that it ultimately, I mean, it's obviously tied to his dad and that from the beginning because he keeps talking about his dad and... So it is that, but then in the end when it's just like, yep, this is what you're missing. This is the thing that you didn't get to see. I love it. And then the other, my favorite, but my, like the one I marked when we were watching it is James Earl Jones. So I agree with you, Kendon. He was my favorite part of this film. High five. Okay. So, let's go into influences and then any other thoughts you guys want to have. I absolutely was influenced by this movie. I saw it at a very young age, not sure, you know, how old, but, saw it many, many, many times. It is something that pops in my head regularly, just in terms of seeing things when I'm at baseball fields, thinking like, if you build it, they will come, like Tim mentioned the catchphrases. What was the other one? Ease his pain and oh, go the distance. I do think it, the dreaming piece of it and the family piece of it is part of like what incorporates into my personality and what makes me me. What do you guys have to say about that stuff?
About influences?
Yeah.
Oh, it's definitely influential. again, to Kenan's point, I think it's a film that people need to see just to get the references, the fact that it's culturally relevant and will be for a long time. And this movie came out in 89 and still you could put on today. You could show it on TNT and TBS, you know, every year, all day long, and people will watch it. Yeah, and it's a fine Kevin Costner performance. It's good seeing Darth Vader hang out in the field with dead ghosts. It's a good time. It's just, you know, there's a certain generation of people who will love this film because baseball was their foundation in baseball. Just like boxing movies, there's a certain generation of people who remember, you know, the heavyweight champ was the biggest sports star in the world, who will gravitate to that. And baseball movies have the same pull for that same generation. And I think it'll speak to them a lot.
I don't know that it was influential on me. I remember seeing it when I was a kid and probably like, okay. I remember watching it sometime in my 20s and being like, this is a well-made movie. So I'm really curious to what degree, essentially almost being 36 and also having a certain length of retrospective on my life, like when I was a kid and stuff like that, made this movie. Or because I was sick that day. So, like, I know it's culturally influential on myself. I can't say that it was influential, like, informing me.
I do think it has some to do with the age that we are watching it, because it definitely meant more to me the most recent time I saw it. And I think, you know, both my parents are alive, and I'm so thankful for that. And I hope that they are alive for lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of years. I love them so much. But I have lost people. And more people have gone who I have loved. And so, like I mentioned, two of my grandparents on my white side. And I think this movie has more meaning to me now because it's things like that. One, they were in my life as a kid when I was watching it, right? So, like, I do think of, like, these particular grandparents when I think of this film. But then also, they are the type of spirits that I would hope that I would see someday. Like, I'm actually to the point of being like, wow, if I could, that would be amazing. So I suspect some of it, Kenan, is your age.
Yeah, and I think there is a significant to what he's dealing with is reaching your father's age at a certain age and then, like, seeing them as a human being as opposed to, a guardian or whatever.
Yeah, totally. It was not long ago that my dad, for my birthday, my dad sent a text like, you were, oh no, it was, I am now the age that he was when we moved back to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, wow, like, you had three kids and were like, it's just amazing. Like, it humanizes your parents a bit and understanding, like, what they were going through and, like, what I don't think I could have done all that. Right now, I don't feel like I'm strong enough for that. It's amazing the adulting they had to do.
At this point, my dad was dealing with, like, a 10-year-old me. It's a terrifying prospect.
I know.
Stop it.
Okay, you guys.
One other thing, real quick. I didn't realize, because I've never seen Bull Durham. Mm-hmm. But, like, that movie was a year before this, and it was another Kevin Costner baseball movie.
Much better movie, by the way. We should do Bull Durham.
Only by 11 points on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you very much.
So, Bull Durham is more baseball. This is like a baseball theme, but
it was lots weird. Of like, because I was on Google just right now and I saw it. And I was like, wait, is that Kevin Costner as well with a baseball bat?
Yeah, Kevin Costner is baseball, right? Didn't he play that one for Love of the Game? I think that was Kevin Costner as well. Like, he's a legit actor to be in baseball movies.
Not a baseball fan.
Well, then that just goes even more to how great of an actor he is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Bill Durham's in the box. I think The Natural, if that's a Robert Redford movie, and I think that is also in the box. And maybe we'll save those for next November.
In Major League, hopefully.
Oh, Major League is definitely in the box. Dun, 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 dun. No. Wild Thing. Dun, 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 dun.
I can't help you because I haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's Wild Thing. I was doing Foxy from Wayne's World. Okay, now, any other thoughts on this, guys? Anything else you want to mention to our friends before we wrap up?
We'll be back.
No. I'm doing the outro first, really quick. Friends, thanks for listening to us this week. Thanks for following us if you are. If you're not, we are on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. You can reach us at mit80s.podcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We would also love ratings and any comments you're willing to share on Applecasts. And then if you want to support us, we have a Patreon account. So if you want to go to patreon.com, we are Made in the 80s or 80s Made. And we appreciate your support. Okay, Kendon. Well, actually, we do know what we're talking about next week, so we'll also give you guys a bit of a teaser. Next week is Top Gun.
Is that a teaser?
It is a teaser. No, they have to wait a whole week.
Straight up. That's a straight. No.
Is
no,
it?
No.
What?
Like, a teaser is, I went to. We'll be back. Do you see?
Okay, so let's try it again. All right, you guys, I'm going to give you a bit of a teaser for next week since we know what we're going to do. You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips.
We'll be back.
Does that work? No? Yeah? Yeah, that works. Kendon, you can be my wingman anytime.
We'll be back.
Try it one more time. No, one more time, Kendon. Over. What will we be?
It's over.
Tim? Yeah. What will it be?
We'll be back.